So I'm going to ask you to recall a time in which you kind of felt mired in helplessness. Again, pick something that's easy, not the most difficult thing. And then I'll lead you through kind of identifying it and walking you through this process. In the process of this, I'm going to read you a little short, I don't know what to call it, piece of prose. In the context of what might bring you back into balance. And then when we're done with that, I'll ask you to break up and maybe share what works for you, or what are the things that you can use as resources. So you'll get a sense of that from this exercise, and then you can kind of explore other things. As I said earlier, there's different things that help us to get back into ground. There's different things that help bring balance. So for you, for each of you, there's a different set of things, but it might be interesting to explore those with somebody, because you might get jogged into going, hey, that's a great idea. I like that one. I didn't think of that. And to kind of brainstorm that a little bit. And then after that, we'll talk about different new responses, different ways of I love Martine Batchelor's phrase, creative engagement. How do we creatively engage in a way that transforms the suffering into compassion? What does that look like? So that's kind of where we're headed. Martine Batchelor she's a teacher. She comes from a background of Korean Zen. She's married to Stephen Batchelor, if you know who he is. She's a French woman, little petite woman, and Stephen is a teacher fairly well known. He's more of the secular Buddhist kind of faction, I guess, if you want to call it that. But she likes to talk about creative engagement, that in some way coming into the present moment and seeing what's present, maybe from a Zen perspective. Here's the Zen terminology. They use a phrase, something about appropriate response. So what is the appropriate response? In other words, we could be very fixed in our view of meditation. So you're sitting here, your eyes are closed, you're paying attention to your breath, you're trying not to get distracted by anything, and you smell smoke. Now, if you're really fixed in your view and your perspective of being a good Buddhist, then you don't open your eyes, you don't look around, and you just keep noticing, well, there's smoke, right? Now, appropriate response would be, huh, that's not very good. I think I should open my eyes, and you see smoke and you see fire. And the appropriate response is leave the room. So there's wisdom that meets that, right? Without wisdom, you sit here going, well, I'm supposed to stay still, and I'm supposed to just notice what's arising for me, and you get burned up with the fire. So appropriate response, or what Martine likes to say, is creative engagement. Because I like the idea of creative engagement, because to recognize that we have many different possibilities if we don't think that we're experts. This is going back to Zen again. I'm going to mix my metaphors. But in Zen, Suzuki Roshi is well known for his statement about beginner's mind. So in the mind of an expert, you have a limited range. But in the mind of a beginner, you have a wide field, right? This is this idea that we started with about distortions of perception and mind and view. When you think you know what it is, I know for sure that's a snake. You've limited any other possibility. When you have an open mind that says, I don't know what that is. That's kind of interesting. It looks like a snake, but maybe it's not. It looks like a stick, maybe it's not. Now you have the possibility of engaging with it in a different way. Does that make sense? Great. So, maybe find a posture that helps you to be connected. Maybe take a few deep breaths. Notice your connection with the floor and the chair. If it's helpful, you can remind yourself to meet whatever arises with some kindness and care. Care for this body that transports you all over the place. Bring to mind a situation in which you felt some sense of helplessness. And first of all, just notice the qualities of that. So what thoughts are going through your head? What are the physical experiences in the body? What does the body feel like? Are there thoughts of this is going nowhere, this is hopeless, why bother? Or are there thoughts of I've got to do something, I've got to find an answer? So notice that there's a different quality based on the different kinds of thoughts. Bless you. Notice how that lands in your body. Is there a sense of lifelessness or a sense of agitation and anxiety? So these are two different types of helplessness. See if you can identify the one that comes up for you as you imagine that situation. And maybe there's both. Maybe it oscillates between the two. And then notice what is arising for you emotionally, and where do you feel that in the body? Can you identify that? Can you in some way lovingly connect with that, recognizing perhaps the suffering of that emotion or even just the challenge? This is difficult. See if there's some way that you can validate or acknowledge, yes, this is here. Not having to push it away, not having to change it. Make space for it. Allow it just to be known, just as it is. Meet it with a kind heart. And see if you can ask yourself, your body in particular, what would bring me back into balance? What would help me find my way back? What would help me to feel grounded and stable? I'll offer you this piece of prose by Courtney Carver called Heart Calling. You are not your past. You are not who people think you are supposed to be. You are not your bank account. You're not your relationships. You aren't what you ate or drank last night. You aren't your bad behavior. You aren't your good behavior either. You are not what you think people think about you. You aren't even what you think about you. You aren't your stuff. You aren't your calendar. You are not your to-do list. Even when all the boxes are checked, you aren't the bad thing someone said you are. You aren't the good thing either. You're not the books you've read, the songs you sing, the mountains you climb, or the cities you visited. You are not your apologies or your accomplishments, your excuses or your loyalty. You are not your best day, and you are not your worst. They are bits and pieces of your life, but they are not you. You are none of those things. But if you're holding on to them too tightly, they are in the way of you knowing who you really are. You may be underneath them, confused by them, distracted by them. All of those things may be so loud and heavy that you can't hear your heart calling, and you've forgotten who you are. You may have forgotten 50 years ago, 5 years ago, or 5 minutes ago. When life gets busy, complicated, and overwhelming, it's easy to forget who you are, but you can find your way back. Sit down. Close your eyes. Breathe. Keep doing that a while. Then put your hands on your heart. There you are. Keep finding your way back. Do it over and over again. Keep remembering, because every time you do, you'll know what matters and what doesn't. What makes you smile and what doesn't. You'll know what's real and what isn't. Sometimes remembering only lasts for a day or two, so you have to keep coming back. When you remember who you are, it's easier to let go of all the things you are not. Trade what drags you down for what lifts you up. Walk away from the things that don't support the real you, so you have more room for the things that do. Sit down. Close your eyes. Breathe. Put your hands on your heart. Repeat forever. What matters to you? What is important? What is your deepest intention? Connect to that. Remind yourself. Let go of what's superficial. In a moment, I'll ask you to just move your body in whatever way your body feels is useful for you in this moment. So take a deep breath. Connect to your body. Ask your body what it feels it needs in this moment, whether it's to stand up or lie down, or to shake or to move. Feel free to do that. Notice that in this moment, you are empowered, that you are doing something, that you can. And then see if you can bring that situation to mind in which you felt helpless. See if you have a different relationship with it now, in this moment. Is there a way that you can creatively engage with that to see a different view or a different perspective or a different way that you could act? Maybe you can even imagine yourself as an embodiment of Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara, and imagine what they would do. What would their response be? In what way would they show up? What would that look like? So when you're ready, you can just bring your attention back to the breath for a few breaths. So find someone to talk with. Maybe share what that was like, or share if something came up for you that was a different response, or whether that was useful or helpful, and in what way. And I'll let you guys navigate the conversation. I'll just be the timekeeper. So I'll be happy to pair up, or let's see, there's one odd person out. Would somebody like to include someone in the conversation to be a threesome? Okay, there's your threesome. So because it's not going to be just a one person share at a time, it'll just be a conversation between the two of you, or the three of you. And you'll get about 5 minutes to talk. and share how that exercise was for you, or if it gave you any insights, or what was useful out of it, if there was anything useful or not. So. Okay. Time's up. So here's an invitation, and that is to make a larger group. So there will be a group of six and a group of, a group of six and a group of seven, I think, is how that's going to work out. Two, 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 yeah. So there's three groups will get together, however that works out. So if you're, whatever group you're in, find two other groups to make a larger circle. Oh, okay, you can make three groups, that's fine too. You could do three groups, 2, 4, and 1, 5. That works too. Okay, so two groups of four, one group of five. That works. Yeah, that's fine. That's what I said. Two groups of four and one group of five. Yeah. So the way this is going to work is you're each going to kind of take a turn, and the idea here is to kind of make it short so that you can go in the circle and do maybe several circles, so several rotations. And the idea is to share something to the group that might be something that you would do to bring yourself into balance, something that you know brings you into balance. So you're kind of sharing that wisdom that you know for yourself into the group, and then the next person will share what works for them. And maybe along the way you'll pick something up where it'll inspire you to think of other ways. Does that make sense? Okay. Great. You can begin. Did everyone get a chance to say something? Yay! Great. So I'm going to invite you to just stay where you are for a moment. Just close your eyes. And I want you to remember a time in which you helped alleviate someone's suffering in whatever way that was. Maybe you just helped somebody in the grocery store, or maybe you just helped somebody that was in need, in whatever way that was. Recall that situation. And take a moment to recall what that felt like as you were doing whatever it was that you did, whatever action that was that you took. Recall what that felt like. Let yourself feel that in the body. Recognize where you feel it, what it feels like. And now I'd like you to contrast that with what it felt like when you saw that that person was suffering, and notice the difference. So this was the before, the thing that motivated you to act. Notice what that felt like. And then come back again to what it felt like when you were actually doing that compassionate action. So, what was that like? What was the difference? Does anybody want to say? Yeah.
Complete relaxation of the breath and settling.
Beautiful.
And just the power of just touch was enormous.
Great.
And, I realized that for a moment, part of that, there was a moment between, and it was a judgment of should I act, do I any kind of authority? Do I even know what I'm doing? Isn't there someone else around here?
It
was a judgment. And it was very much in my way for a moment. And I just had to break through that.
Yeah, great. Anybody else want to say what the contrast was like for them? What was it like to recall the moment of actually acting and how that felt? Anybody want to say what that was like?
Well, for me, it's an opening in the chest. And then when I act, it's a very expansive feeling.
Beautiful.
In the same
Nice. Did anybody experience anything different?
Relief?
Yeah. But there was a feeling of better, right? There was some positive affect that you experienced, right? Did anybody not feel that? So I wanted to tease out, because I realized that we didn't actually tease out that whole thing about empathy and compassion, how they're different. So empathy is the resonating with what's happening for that person, so it might be that feeling of confusion, or maybe even feeling sad if the person's sad, or feeling some discomfort if somebody's in a situation of discomfort. That's empathy. It's the mirror. It's like mirror neurons, right? You see somebody and you feel the same way. It might even be that you see somebody who's happy and you feel happy. So that's also empathy. But in the context of suffering, empathy is this resonance with what's happening. Compassion, on the other hand, has a positive affect. And it's this quality of opening the heart. It's this quality of like boundlessness or this warmth or this openness. That's why it's called one of these, the Brahmaviharas are called boundless states, right? And I like to think of, so I love the way both of you described this kind of a little bit of clutching at first before it opened. Because sometimes fear gets in the way or other things get in the way, or maybe our uncertainty, our doubt, maybe somebody else will do something instead of me. Why me? Right? And I like to think of it as, it's a little bit like a garden hose. Have you ever done that with a garden hose where it's got water coming out and you bend the hose so it holds the water back? So the constriction that we feel is like bending that hose. And the moment that we release the constriction, the water comes out, right? And that's the natural thing, is that the water wants to come out of the hose. The compassion actually wants to come out in response to suffering. But a lot of times we get in the way of it. We constrict it because of fear, because of some judgment. They don't deserve that, or I feel like they shouldn't get that, or maybe even just maybe somebody else will do that. But the moment that our heart constricts or tightens, then it closes the access to compassion. The moment that we can just even give it a little crack, boof, we get compassion that responds. And if we connect to that, what's really important is connecting to that uplifted or expanded or this open heart feeling, that we can actually not be afraid of compassion. Often we're afraid of the empathy piece. And that's the place we usually get stuck, is we get stuck in the, this is terrible, this is really sad, this is really depressing, this is, you know, awful. And our thoughts get propagated out from there. So this is that distortion of thought. We perceive something terrible. Our thoughts go into that whole spiral, which kind of goes downward. But if we open to compassion, what happens is there's a movement of the heart that opens. And we're not stuck in the rumination of how terrible that is. It actually feels good to be helping somebody. It actually feels good to be alleviating someone's discomfort in whatever way that we can. And if we tap into that, find nourishment in that. And so compassion, sometimes you'll hear the phrase compassion fatigue. As a compassion teacher, I hate that phrase because it's actually not compassion fatigue, it's empathy fatigue. Those of you who know who Matthew Ricard is, he's considered the happiest man in the world. He's been put into MRI machines, you know, fMRI machines, and looking at his brain and all that. And he's been given things like, okay, so you're going to practice empathy for a while, and we want to watch your brain. And he'll tell everybody how exhausting that is. You know, he's exhausted if he has to stay just with empathy. But if they allow him to do compassion practice, he says, I can do that all day. So I want to point that out, because sometimes we conflate the two and we get mixed up with the two. And so we think compassion is depressing or compassion is exhausting. And not to say that you can't burn out if you don't take care of yourself, right? So part of this is the balance, finding the balance to care for yourself. So when you find that you have too much, you're overwhelmed, or you're burned out, or you're tired, physically tired, you need to care for yourself as part of the equation. That not caring for yourself actually makes you less able to respond to those who need you. So it's better that you take care of yourself. It's not in a narcissistic way or a selfish way, but it's so that you can be more available in a better way for the other person that needs you. So I want to show you one last video. This is Sharon Salzberg, and she talks a little bit about this thing about burning out.
Serious burnout. How do you avoid that?
I think it's almost inevitable that we get burnt out, at least
from time to time. And that's one reason why I think it's important to understand the distinction, because we'll take a journey through the terrain of burnout and overwhelm, I think almost undoubtedly. And we need to be able to realize that that's what's going on and work towards some other balance, not only for our sake, but for the sake of those who are trying to help.
And just to amplify that point, there is a difference between burnout and compassion.
Yeah, there is a difference between burnout and compassion. If you just think about what the science shows, especially somebody like Tanya Singer at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, is the difference between what she calls empathy and what she's calling compassion. And actually, different regions of the brain where empathy is that first part, it's the resonance. It's sensing the stress, the difficulty someone is likely feeling. And then compassion is one of many possible responses. So you might genuinely sense someone's difficulty and then forget about it. Or you might feel overwhelmed, exhausted, I can't bear to be here. Or you might be blaming, or all kinds of things. And compassion implies a kind of stability of attention. You're not going to fall into it and get overwhelmed. It implies a kind of balance, because you're caring about yourself as well as about someone else. It also implies a sort of wisdom or intelligence, like, it's not all up to me. You know, I can't fix the world for you. I can't make it the perfect world.
For those of us, maybe on the more selfish end of the spectrum, who feel like compassion sounds nice, but I can't solve every problem, I can't function effectively if I'm just sucking to everybody's drama all the time, you're saying, actually, this is manageable if you have equanimity.
That's right. You can't function if you're just sucking in, you know, into all of that pain and difficulty. But there is a balance that's really crucial.
And the balance is you can acknowledge the suffering, you can want to help, but you recognize that you can't solve everything, and you can't force other people to make smarter decisions.
That's right. I mean, this is a little early for you, but an example that's often used is a parent whose child is now an adult, and you know, there's love, there's tenderness, there's care, there's joy in their accomplishments, and there's an inability to determine exactly how they're going to live their lives. And so there needs to be a kind of letting go with that.
My father says the hardest thing about having kids is letting them make their own mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's compassion with equanimity.
That's right.
Which he's been more or less good at.
So, balance, equanimity. I want to read this from Ajahn Pasano. Equanimity is not indifference. It is the ability to return to a place of stillness, to be non-reactive and to weigh things carefully. This is an important quality, especially when considering social action or social responsibility. Without equanimity, we can get drawn into our own reactiveness, our views and opinions. We can think that we're always right, that other people are just a bunch of idiots. It's easy to get turned around and out of balance, not being drawn into the web of our views and opinions, but being able to settle and reflect, to ask, what is the way of balance? Equanimity is essential in undertaking social action. So, you know, at some point during the day I mentioned that we have to have both wisdom and compassion. We could have all compassion, in which sometimes we call it idiot compassion, because sometimes we just go all out and we actually do more harm than good. So we have to have this balance of what is right, what is appropriate. How do I utilize my resources in a skillful way? How much is too much? You know, if I try to help everyone that comes my way, maybe I get exhausted and now I'm not available for anyone. So what is the right amount? And for each one of us, it's a different number. So finding that. Any questions? I want to just check in with you before I close the day. Yes?
You gave us a poem. I think it was recorded.
Probably. Oh, yeah. It's called Home.
No, it wasn't the Home.
Oh. Let's see.
The one from the refugee?
No, not the refugee.
That's Home.
The one about Call Me a Fraud?
Yeah, the prose piece. A woman read it. No, you wrote it. Maybe you read it.
The one about You Are Not Your Past?
Yes.
Courtney Carver. Called Heart Calling, a wake-up call for the real you. Heart Calling.
Who was the quote, the one you just read about social action?
That was from Ajahn Pasano, and it's from a book called The Dhamma and the Real World. It's a book by both Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. And you can find it on the Abhayagiri website, probably as a PDF download or a Kindle or something. He has a wonderful piece here about social action. Maybe I'll just read you the first paragraph out of here because I love it. Because sometimes I feel like we don't do much as Buddhists in terms of social action. So, from a Buddhist perspective, anything to do with other people can be considered social action. How we relate to the individuals close to us, such as family or neighbors, to society at large, and to the world around us. The field of social action expands out, but it begins with ourselves and our relationships to others. The individual is at the core of all relationships between any parts of society. We must always return to that core, to recognize that our own actions affect other people and the society around us. This is simply the basic law of karma. Anything we do affects ourselves and others. It's not a matter of me and society, as if they were separate. There really isn't any separation. The two are interrelated all the time. So how we are in the world really is important. You know, there's a lot that people will say that hate is contagious, but also kindness can be contagious. And there are studies that show that. Happiness is also contagious. And so those actually ripple out about 3 degrees. So they not only affect the people in your circle, but the people in their circle. And one more level out. So if you're kind to somebody in the grocery store or in line or on the road, maybe you have an effect. You might not know it. But maybe somebody's having a hard day and your word of kindness makes all the difference to them. There was a story that I was looking for, but I thought I printed it. It's probably sitting in my printer at home. It's a story about a person. I don't know if you recognize the name. His name's Christian Piccolini. He was quite involved in the white nationalist, white supremacy groups. And he talked about how he changed, how he actually turned around. And he said the first part was that he and his wife had a baby, and so that kind of started to make him shift a little bit. And he realized he couldn't do the activist parts that he was doing, so he decided to open up a record store to sell white nationalist records with all this hate speech in it. But he realized that they wouldn't let him open up the record store if it was just that, so he carried other records, which meant that other people would come into the record store. And over time, he started to have conversations with these people coming into the record store. And just imagine how you might have a conversation with somebody maybe going to the record store or the bookstore or the grocery store, and you keep seeing somebody over and over again because they work there, and you have a conversation. And he said it was the compassion that he received from people that came into the book or into the record store that started to shift his realization that he was not so different from them, and that actually he was closer to them than the people that he had connected with in the white supremacist group. And he realized that he didn't want to be like them anymore, and that shifted his whole relationship. But I think it's a story about compassion, that when we offer friendliness, that maybe it starts to shift somebody in a way that we might not know immediately, that it might be a lot of little conversations that are based in kindness and compassion that start to soften somebody's heart and change how they feel about the world. It might actually change them from being a hater to somebody who actually starts to be kind. It turns out he's now part of an organization that works with people who have been in these hate groups, that are getting out of these hate groups and connecting with them and helping them to do more compassionate action in the world. And I just thought that was such a amazing story about how we don't necessarily see the effect that we have. Maybe all these people probably didn't know that they were affecting this guy, but they were just being kind and they were talking to him and sharing a little bit of their life and asking how his life was. And suddenly he realized, I don't want to be this person that hates people. I want to be a person that really cares about others. So what we do is consequential. How we are is consequential. So I want to end with one last poem. And this is from a songwriter and musician, Carrie Newcomer. Somewhere someone needs help. If you can't get there yourself, take a deep breath. Breathe in. Hold that someone in your heart. Lighten the weight of their troubles. Breathe out. Open your heart. Release what you cannot change. Send calm and courage and human connection. For the nights can be filled with shadows, and sometimes the waters rise. Someone somewhere needs help. Send love. It matters. So I pick that poem because that's a little bit of the essence of Tonglen. And for those of you who may not be familiar with it, it's a Tibetan practice, but it's this idea of breathing in the suffering of the world and breathing out all of these good qualities, offering strength, offering courage, offering love, offering even happiness and joy. To recognize that you have a lot in you that you can share with others. And even though it doesn't look like we're doing anything, you know, how we are does ripple out. If you're a kind person in the world that you connect with, that you interact with, it makes a difference. It shares something that maybe that person has not experienced. Maybe it's a person who's experienced a lot of abuse and they've not ever had anybody offer them some kindness or a kind touch or a kind hand. Maybe it's somebody who's used to having slurs and names called at them. And just your willingness to offer kindness may be all that they need. Maybe it's the balm that they need. Maybe it's the courage that they need to maybe leave a bad situation. Maybe it's the light that the Buddha talks about being a lamp unto yourself, and that you can be that lamp for someone, that lamp that points to refuge. So I hope this has been a beneficial day for all of you. I ask your forgiveness if in any way I harmed anyone in the process, because sometimes we don't know. So this is speaking to blind spots. Maybe I said something that was offensive to someone. If I did, I didn't mean it with any intent to harm. And I wish you well in your practice. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your willingness to engage and to even go into places that might have been challenging or difficult today. Thank you.